We're going to get started. Welcome everybody to our weekly CRECA lecture. I'm Ted Gerber, I'm the director of CRECA for those who don't know me, and I'm not going to introduce today's speaker. In fact, Professor Bob Kaiser from the Geography Department will have that honor. But I do want to mention a few upcoming CRECA events for those who might be interested. And we actually have several things to announce this week. So most immediately, tomorrow at 4:30 p.m., there will be a reception hosted by CRECA, and this will take place at the photo exhibit of work by Jonas Bendixson, which is currently being exhibited at the Porter Butts Gallery, the Porter Butts Gallery at the Memorial Union. And tomorrow we're having a sort of big reception to celebrate the presentation of this very fascinating photo exhibit, which is called Satellites, Photographs from the Fringes of the Former Soviet Union. It's a series of photographs that the photographer took in various regions of the former Soviet Union that have been in various states of conflict and had various types of... states of conflict in various degrees of... various temperatures. So some of them are frozen conflicts, some of them are less frozen conflicts, some of them are hot spots. There's a sort of a continuum. But anyway, it's a very fabulous photo exhibit, and we're very lucky to have it. It's actually being presented at the U until November 10th, but tomorrow we're having a nice reception at which Professor Kaiser himself will be making some remarks. And
they'll sound familiar.
And we'll also have some refreshments available, so please join us and tell all your friends about it. That's tomorrow, 4:30, Porter Butts Gallery. The next week, we have a number of events. So first, I want to call your attention to an event that is not a CRECA event as such, but it is actually quite relevant to those of us who are interested in the area, and that's the performance by the Vivsky Ukrainian National Dance Company, which takes place Wednesday at 8 p.m. and it's at the Wisconsin Union Theater. So all the information for these events you can find at the way out. So by all means, if you like Ukrainian folk dance, or you like Ukrainian dance, you like folk dance, or you like dance, I encourage you to check out this wonderful event. And then finally, our lecture for next week is slightly different. We're not going to have a lecture. Instead, it's going to be a poetry reading entitled Between Dawn and the Wind, by Anna Freilich, I think is how you pronounce it, who is a poet and senior lecturer in Polish at Columbia University. So please join us here a week from now, same time, same place, for a poetry reading. Something
else. One more thing. There's a sign-up sheet that's going around.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, sign-up sheet for our mailing list or email list if you're interested in not already on it. Okay, so now let me introduce Bob Kaiser, Professor of Geography, who will introduce our speaker for today.
Thanks, Ted. Thanks, everybody, for coming out. And it is a great pleasure to have Alex back. I hadn't realized this. Alex hasn't been back since, I think, 2003, at the time that he actually defended. He was my first PhD, so be gentle with him today. He's... Alex, when he came in, my favorite memory of Alex was when he first came in, sort of very bright-eyed, really eager to get going, and came in, well, I've got two master's degrees already in geography, I've done political geography, I've concentrated on the Middle East, I've got some Arabic, and so I'm ready to launch into Central Asian studies and become a Central Asian geographer. And he saw this as sort of an opening opportunity, a place that really was understudied, and was really ready to go. And I looked at Alex and I said, well, I hate to tell you this, Alex, but Arabic's not going to do you a whole lot of good in Central Asia. You're going to really need a Turkic language from the region, and of course you're going to need Russian as well. And Alex got depressed. But the positive thing about Alex was he only stayed depressed for about 24 hours. And then he said, okay, sign me up. Where do I sign up? And he started taking Kazakh and Russian side by side as he went into all these grad courses and seminars and all this sort of heavy theoretical stuff, and sort of went through brilliantly, fairly quickly, got funding from IREX, from the SSRC, from the NSF, did a year and a half, maybe even 2 years all told, of field work in Mongolia and in Kazakhstan. And what he'll be presenting here today is sort of a culmination of that work, sort of tracing through those Kazakhs who left Kazakhstan, lived in this diasporic community in Western Mongolia, and then were being sort of called back to the homeland with Kazakhstan's independence, following them back to Kazakhstan as well, and sort of tracing those that decided not to come back and those that returned as well. So a lot of work, a lot of field work went into this. It's great work that has just now been published as a book as well, and just in time for Christmas. So okay, so with that, take it away, Al.
Thanks. Thank you very much. Well, let me begin by thanking Krika for the invitation and for all of you for showing. I know this is the weekend of the Central Eurasian Studies Society meeting, and so I'm very impressed that there's this many people here. Beyond that, let me begin, as I do all my public talks, by announcing right off the bat that I stutter. I do that so that if it crops up, I don't have to pretend I'm not doing it. You don't have to pretend I'm not doing it. Hopefully, all the words will eventually come out. As Bob mentioned, this is the culmination of quite a bit of work, and it is the fruit of that labor, and it is really an honor to be able to come back and share it, the institution that trained me and with the people who trained me. I thought what I'd do is try to launch into this in a manner that might help some of the grad students so that you can really see how a project of this nature begins and then the arc that it covers. I was very fortunate to receive quite a bit of funding, as Bob mentioned, National Science Foundation, MacArthur, IREC, Social Science Research Council. Kennan, it just went on and on. And the universities with which I was associated also supported me wonderfully. The timeline. Preliminary research and language training occurred here at Wisconsin, also Iowa, and in Indiana. These are, of course, some of the prime places to get Central Asian Studies training. I got the SSRC pre-dissertation fellowship, which was invaluable. It got me over there. I had the opportunity to spend a year at, or 6 months at Indiana, and then 6 months in Kazakhstan. And it was there that I really started to jump into this particular topic. I had actually started off wanting to do this grand study of all the minority groups within Kazakhstan. And I was going to look at each one of them and find out how they were adapting to this new homeland, this new state. And Mark Beisinger actually pulled me aside and he said, if you do that, you will not publish this until you're 80. There's just way too much there. You need to pick two. And I said, two. So I ended up picking the Germans and the Koreans as two distinct groups, both with a similar history in terms of being displaced, Stalinist displacement. But then they reacted very differently to the emergence of an independent Kazakhstan. The Germans largely migrated out, and the Koreans decided to stay and redefine themselves as Kazakhstani citizens. But it was there that the fieldwork began, and this took 8 months in Kazakhstan, eventually 4 months in Mongolia, 2 months in Kyrgyzstan, and a month in Russia, each time doing research. And one of the really exciting parts of this was how, in researching the Germans and Koreans, I began to actually visit the areas of compact living where these groups lived. And in doing so, I saw a lot of abandoned homes that were now being filled by Kazakhs returning to Kazakhstan, or migrating, probably better put, migrating to Kazakhstan. And that's when I jumped into this particular topic. I thought, how truly fascinating. Eventually, this turned into the dissertation, where I was very fortunate to get the write-up fellowship from the SSRC, and then a postdoc at the Kennan Institute, wherein I wrote the first book on the Germans and Koreans, and have just recently published the book on the topic that I'll be speaking on today. So, into the topic. Theoretically, the theoretical concerns here really revolve around the broader idea of homeland psychology, the notion that who we are is highly impacted by where we feel we belong, and equally so by where we feel we do not belong, and that this is socially constructed, and hence a terrifically important thing to be studied in realms like the former Soviet Union, with so many people living in outside of the territories defined as their ethno-national homelands. This study also takes place at the intersection of place, power, and identity, looking at the idea of post-nationalization and deterritorialization, the argument that the globalization is creating a flat world and a world of flows will replace the world of places. And I found that problematic. I started to wonder that if we see deterritorialization, will we not see reterritorialization at a different scale? Clearly, a great group to study in this would be diasporic groups who are often identified or projected as being placeless. And I thought, is that true? I wanted to really investigate that. And thus, I come to the question of the scale of place attachment. And if, in fact, that is malleable. This, of course, brings in the literature on transnationalism and hybridity. And, of course, the clunky terms kin states, host states, and the very process of repatriation. So we'll see how all this weaves together in this particular case study. As I mentioned earlier, I was doing research with the Germans and Koreans and a number of other groups in the areas of compact living, and thus I came to really encounter the process of return migration. And it was really with these abandoned homes, with the Kazakhs failing them, that I started to become terrifically interested in that question of return. Were these Kazakhs actually returning? Many of them had never experienced Kazakhstan. So how could it be termed return? Well, to study this, I had to jump full bore into the histories, first off. And that leads me to the history of the Mongolian Kazakhs. This land here, historically, is largely a Turkic homeland. There are a number of different groups that who had some overlap between the Mongolian ethno-tribal spectrum and the Kazakh ethno-tribal spectrum. The most important for me were the Karay and the Naiman. Both tribal names are represented within the Kazakh and Mongolian ethnic spectrum. We see also in Mongolia evidence of historic Turkic habitation. These are Turkic grave sites, often referred to by the local Kazakhs as ancient Kazakh grave sites. These predate the advent of the Kazakh ethnonym, but nevertheless are definitely symbols for the Mongolian Kazakhs as to their rightful place in this Mongolian territory. So, and this is a history that most of you know, eventually Turkic tribes begin migrating west. You start to get the occupation of areas that today hold very different names, but at one point were known as the Dashti Kipchak, Mahonahr, Fargana, and so on. Eventually, the melding with the Persian or Iran, Farsi-speaking locals in this region, and the manifestation of modern Central Asian peoples. Going back to the Mongolian Kazakhs, I think their spatiality might be best understood in terms of isolation and insulation. And that is because they exist primarily here in the westernmost Imag, or province, of Mongolia, an area called Bayan-Olgi. And this map is actually inaccurate in that there's about a 60 to 120 kilometer gap from the easternmost portion of Kazakhstan to the westernmost portion of Mongolia. I've actually been doing some work on that recently. But the idea is that these groups have existed here, largely isolated during the Soviet period from the Russification that was so prominent within the Kazakh SSR, but also because of the remoteness of Bayan-Olgi from an overt Mongolization that might have occurred based on that cultural paradigm. Here's another issue here. The Kazakhs are, in fact, the largest minority group within Mongolia. The Halka are the predominant group. And then the Kazakhs come in at roughly 6% today, closer to 4. And the rest of these are actually part of the Mongolian ethnic spectrum. These are the Oirat, or Western Mongols. One interesting point here is that the Kazakhs are, of course, not part of that Mongolian ethnic spectrum. They are a Turkic Muslim people, and hence very, very different, but occupying a very unique position within the Mongolian society. Here's a graphic representation of the population distribution of Kazakhs. You see them highly concentrated here in Bayan-Olgi, some in the main city of Ulaanbaatar, and a few scattered into some mining towns in the central part of the city of the state. This also, though, speaks to that isolation-insulation idea in that the transportation infrastructure from Ulaanbaatar to Bayan-Olgi is extremely limited. There is no railroad that spans the country east-west. There is no paved road that spans the country east-west. So this was sort of the Indiana Jones component of my field research, where it was horseback and camel and uaz and all the excitement therein. Today there are actually plans to incorporate Mongolia into the broader transportation networks of East Asia. This road here is supposed to, what was supposed to have been built in 2000, hence its name, the Millennium Highway, but it has yet to really be built. There are sections, but it hasn't really been fully constructed yet. And this is a diagram of how they of the route that they're thinking of taking. But this will overtly problematize that insulation factor that the Mongolian Kazakhs have enjoyed for a long time, in that they will now be far more integrated into the broader state practices of Mongolia. And should this road connect up to those of Central Asia and Russia, we will see a lot more in interaction between the Mongolian Kazakhs and others. So we now turn to think about how the Mongolian Kazakhs, in fact, have a measure of cultural compatibility, how they have been able to exist for centuries within Mongolia. This involves a lot of the overlap that relates to their pastoral nomadic traditions. This is a statue of a Kazakh. How do we know? The hat, the eagle, the saddle, and the boots give us a clear sense that this is a Kazakh, not a Mongol. But they've been able to also maintain their distinctness as Kazakhs. The language has far fewer loan words than does the Kazakhs, the Kazakh language of Kazakhstan. They maintain eagle hunting, which has been lost among many of the Kazakh groups around the world. The nomadic traditions, as I mentioned, provide a certain overlap. There is a sense that these Mongols and these Kazakhs understand each other. They understand what it is to own animals, to lose horses, to need horses, to need fodder, and that provides a great deal of compatibility. More than that, they have a certain shared history. Kazakhs fought beside Mongols to try to throw off the yoke of the Qing dynasty. They also fought beside Mongols in trying to repel the Japanese during World War II. So there is a certain shared history there. And more than that, Choi Bal Song, who in the 30s was Stalin's representative within Mongolia, punished the Kazakhs almost equally as he punished the local Mongols. Most of the Buddhist lamas were actually killed during that time, but equally so the Kazakh mullahs. So I begin to then research the scale of place attachment, finding out if Kazakhs in fact see themselves as territorialized to Mongolia as a whole, or more specifically to Bayanogi, a small-scale homeland. And here we have certain interesting historical factors of the ethno-territorial articulation of Kazakhs. There's some stories relating here. There was there was Sheikh Shikai, the Chinese warlord, who switched sides in the 1930s. He had been largely allied with the Russians. He then switches sides and links up with the Chinese nationalist government. The Soviets did not like this, and they actually helped support the Osman rebellion by funneling arms through Western Mongolia. And hence, Bayanolgi is then manifest as a partially autonomous imag for Kazakhs and also for the Ranghai Mongols, a group that there's always been in question as to whether they're Turkified Mongols or Mongolized Turks. There's some question as to their ethnic origins. Also, though, we have Bayanolgi in terms of its socioeconomic position. Being as isolated as it's been during the Soviet period, a lot of the supplies came down from central Russian cities. With the collapse of the Soviet Union, those supply lines stopped, and Bayanolgi became increasingly marginalized. With the difficulty of transportation infrastructure here, there was a serious amount of deprivation, and that could, in fact, have set up some of this longing for homeland, and I think has to be considered in this equation. We also look at demographic shifts. During the 1990s, a lot of the Mongols within Bayanolgi migrated out. They didn't like being associated with the Turkic peoples there, and sometimes thus being identified as Turkic people. So you saw some Mongol emigration. But also the Kazakhs began an active process of Kazakhifying or Kazakhizing Bayanolgi. They started with iconography, often putting up a lot of Kazakh heroes. More than that, there were distinct efforts to rename things. Streets, sometimes mountains. There was even a proposal to rename the IMAG Bayolgi as opposed to Bayanolgi, so thus Turkifying it. That was rejected out of hand. But what you saw in the 90s was this: were discourses of migration and territorialization, both deterritorializing Kazakhs and reterritorializing them, in the sense that there were serious debates in the newspapers, both Kazakh language and Mongol language newspapers, that were calling for Kazakhs to recognize that they had been treated well, that they should remain, that they have a lot more in common with the Mongols than they don't, and that they should embrace their nationality, their Mongolian nationality, as they have been understood as a particular Undestan or nationality within the broader Mongolian nationality. Some of these were particularly interesting in that as Mongolia redefined itself as a civic nation, it in many ways rejected the inner Mongols, arguing that they don't belong, rejected often Tuvans, but embraced Kazakhs, the Turkic Muslim people within, saying, you belong, as fellow felt tent dwellers, you belong, where those other groups outside of Mongolia proper don't. It's an interesting process. But also we see consistent efforts to push an identity that is firmly Kazakh. And in that process, with transnational flows of textbooks and of Kazakh language newspapers, increasingly a lot of Kazakhs began to see themselves as out of place. And this often manifested in return myths. Now, I did a lot of surveys and asked, did these return myths exist throughout time? Well, people often said, of course, my grandfather said it, his great-grandfather said it, but very often, through interviews, I was able to realize that these often manifested only in the 90s when the opportunities came about and the transnational discourses of reterritorialization took this form. You see here the train coming back, people happy to have them. Here, people running back to Kazakhstan. But note here, once in Kazakhstan, the people have their heads bowed and the baby is crying. That is because a lot of Kazakhs who had these grand dreams of this ethnic return migration, where they would be welcomed with open arms by their homeland, actually found a question when they got back. Is this Kazakhstan, land of the Kazakhs, or is this Kazakhstanistan, the land of the Kazakhstani? So I began to research that. I went to Kazakhstan and explored these kind of questions, noting that throughout the early 90s, there was a powerful discourse of Kazakhstan, an ethnic homeland for Kazakhs. The 1993 Constitution defined the state specifically as an ethnic homeland for Kazakhs, arguing that there is no other place in the world for them, thus implying that other groups have homelands that they could go to, but this is for Kazakhs. The language policy was a little bit more aggressive at that time, certainly identifying Russian as the language of international communication, but Kazakh became the official state language. A complex process when you had billboards saying it is the responsibility of all Kazakhstani citizens to learn Kazakh. But there was also powerful civic national discourse there, a Kazakhstanistan discourse that basically called, with the rewriting of the 1995 Constitution, defining Kazakhstan as a homeland to all peoples who live within. And you saw a large-scale media campaign engaged to promote this. Here you have written both in Kazakh and Russian, Mening Otanim, Kazakhstan, Maya Rodina, Kazakhstan, my homeland or my nation is Kazakhstan. But notice the imagery is still very much of a Kazakh flavor. Emigration, obviously, occurred here, largely among the groups of European stock. You saw them leaving. Not all of them went to Canada, but a lot of these groups engaged in ethnic return migrations. You see here, I'm sorry, that's probably a little bit small, but the changes in population were quite profound. In 1991, with independence, Kazakhs represented roughly 41% of the population. In the land of the Kazakhs, they were in fact a minority. By 1999, they allegedly achieved an ethno-demographic majority at 53.4%. It was terrifically important for them. They felt that this was highly significant. And this led to certain changes, a certain Kazakhizing process in the national iconography. Here you have the three judges of the Kazakhstani Supreme Court, each one representing one of the Jews. But ironically, you don't see the fourth member representing perhaps the majority of the population that is not Kazakh. Why not have a judge there? An interesting question. More so, you also see more pastoral imagery used in a lot of the public statues. People ask the question, what is the role of the returning diaspora? What are they intended to provide? Some argue that they were brought in for the hardening of space. The idea that certain oblasts within Kazakhstan were overwhelmingly Russian, and it was this returning diaspora that was to be settled there and thus dilute the Russian population and establish a more firm loyalty to the Kazakhstani state by implanting newly returned Kazakhs. The reclamation of traditional culture. Most of these Kazakhs coming back from Xinjiang, coming back from Mongolia, all spoke Kazakh, a pure Kazakh. They brought back greater knowledge of the traditional nomadic practices. And so the idea that they could infuse Kazakhstan with some memories of that purely Kazakh past. Others say that they were primarily a resource for exploitation, bringing them in to replace the labor force that was being lost through emigration of the European groups. Yet one of the big questions was this: why establish a quota system? Well, some of that relates to the limited resources available to the Kazakhstani government to actually integrate these people. It started off with rather large quotas, 60,000, 42,000, 30,000, but throughout the 90s it got smaller and smaller because there was a realization that they weren't facilitating their integration into Kazakhstani society well. A broad discourse of dissatisfaction emerged within the Kazakhstani newspapers, where the Oralman, Oralu being the Kazakh verb to return, man anthropomorphizes it, and dar being the plural and ending. But the Oralmandar were talking about how they didn't feel necessarily welcome, that they had in many ways not been integrated into Kazakhstan. And this relates to settlement planning. Some of the settlement planning issues were actually quite interesting in that availability of housing was somewhat limited. They weren't really building new housing, so they settled them in the abandoned housing of the emigrants. Here's an example of this. We also have availability of jobs. A lot of the Kazakhs coming back from Western Mongolia and Xinjiang were in fact herders. Some elites came back with Russian training and were able to integrate into the higher rungs of the socioeconomic ladder. But a great many of them came back with strictly herding practices. And thus, they had to be settled in areas where they could enact those particular skills. The red represents the cattle raising and the green represents sheep. But in both cases, it actually plays out well because these were some of the more predominantly Russian oblasts, and there was some question of Uzbek groups here, so transplanting Kazakhs there was good for the government. So we also have the issue of the future of the Oralmandar. And hence, we confront their secondary migrations. It became very difficult to research these groups because they often held as an ideal their nomadic traditions. So once back in Kazakhstan, given a particular place to settle with this dissatisfaction, they would pack up and move. Interestingly, they often tried to congregate with people from their former site of diasporic existence. So coming back, you would see groups of Mongolian Kazakhs congregate, groups of Afghanistani Kazakhs congregate, groups from Iran, Turkey, and so on. Sometimes even even in enacting cultural practices that had been learned in that diasporic venue. An example would be the Nadam festival from Mongolia was actually carried out in a number of different oblasts within Kazakhstan as some of these Kazakhs lived out the Mongolian national Olympics, primarily three sports, archery, wrestling, and horseback riding. Many of the groups sought to settle in subnational homelands, meaning sometimes not wanting to go back to Kazakhstan, but wanting to go back to the land of the Naiman, the land of the Kerey, within Kazakhstan. So identifying a subscale of place to which they wish to attach themselves. Also, climatic similarity turned out to be rather important for them. Many of these migrations were driven by arguments that it was too humid in a particular place or too cold, so they wanted to reset themselves. But many of them confronted a true problem, particularly the herders who did not receive Russian language training abroad. So when they came back, the pervasiveness of Russian within the Kazakhstani society was terrifically troublesome for them. It was troublesome in terms of jobs and also integrating into the social networks. Here's an interesting example of a museum display that basically called for Kazakhstani cultural purity. But what they used was Orolmon artwork. And I went there with a recent migrant, and he walked in and he said, "This butter churn, this loom, this musket, these are things that my parents are using today in by an oldie, but here they're in a museum." And this was troubling to him. This was an interesting process to really watch. I'm going to play you a little clip of a film now. It's by a director named Bulat Shatter. And it is a film, and I'll just set it up for you a bit, where we pick it up, a grandmother. Well, let me back up a little bit. There was a Kazakh maiden who was pregnant with the child from a Kazakh Red Army officer in the 1930s. Her father is liquidated during a collectivization process. She then leads her clan into Xinjiang, escapes with her unborn child, gives birth to that child, Zamanai, within Xinjiang. He is raised there, dies in a mining accident, but not before he produces a son, Amanai. And the grandmother decides, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, to take Amanai back to the land of his ancestors, back to Kazakhstan. So where we pick up the story, she has led him into the mountains. They're crossing the Tian Shan, and she decides to lay down in this cave and die. She's just exhausted, and Amanai is somehow at seven or whatever, supposed to make it the rest of the way on his own. But she has a dream as she's dying, and where she confronts the Red Army officer. She confronts Zamanai. She confronts Zamanai's wife, Alima, each one giving her a sense of how they perceive homeland. And I hope this will be interesting to you.
Қамқорсыз өздері қырықтар дәрменсіз жандар ортасына әдейі етіп тапсырғандай көрінесің. Мен де торда жатып жан жағына жиырыла қарайтын жұмар
сияқтымын.
Енді мен аямадым шіркінді. Тек сенен сұрайтынмын халакеріне. Әлимаға түсіндір. Аман айдаман сақтасын. Мүмкін мен көрмеген әкемді. Ол көрер. Аманатын сол жеткізер. Thank you. 어디서 듣던 건다고 덮은 박도 수박은 것은 이전 눈에 든 보던 거야. 어이없어.
헤야 좀 따위. 신들 울으라도 막다는 경우에 할때 줄었다 두실로 신들 으깨성 씨는 군복이만 음을 보이 고르기는 속수박 들으며 속었어. 토호구라는데 팔간 이른다 싶더라도 모이는 으가이다이 보듯 어둡도 어둡 즐거는 게 있으려는데
아이 나를 빈보다 미사와 더군다 빈가가 더군은 일민들에게 아싸는 것을 어둡밤에 미실테크 의심민들에게 헛빛게 나둔다든 속 살아봤는 하마은 갈라는 말이더소 오는 우리방은 사는 상관을 하는 주면서 Дұрыс айтасың, әрең түсінбейсің. Елін жерін тастап кеткен адам. Одан деген сөзді, ол сөзден пайда болу. Одансыз адамға әрең түсінесіз. Мен соңғы жолға шапқанда, отан үшін, Сталин үшін деп ұмтылдым. Сен ертіп кеткен қасқандардың қапалына, ол мүлдем түсініксіз.
Сонда сен ұрпақты айыптамақпысың. Сен сол ұрпақ үшін. Не қалдырдың? Сен мадақтаған, өз өмірімді құрбан еткен үкіметің не қалдырды?
Оған мүмкін әлі емеспін, адам өмір сүрді.
Мен де адам өмір сүрдім, оған өкінбеймін. Бірақ адалдық дегенде әркім өзінше түсінеді ғой.
Көп сөз айтамыз, заман айқайна. Ол да сен сияқты ұйымдастап, қаңғырып кетті ме? Әлде бір жерде қаза тапты ма? Айт.
There's one more clip.
Күйеуге шығуына қарсылығым жоқ. Сыман айды, күтуді я күттің, күдір өзетін жаққа жеттің. Бірақ, менің көзім тірі тұрғанда, аман айды беретте ойлама.
Ағапа неге бұрсың? Олың едің ұлың ес. Мен жалғызымды тастап қайда барам.
Ол сенің ғана ұлың емес. Заман айдың дұлы. Заман ай менің ұлым. Заман айды елінен, ата мекенінен алып кетіп адастырғаным да жетер. Енді заман айдың ұлын адастырар шерін жоқ. Аман айдың жұмағы, ата мекені, оны заман айын көр алмады, оған күнәлімен. Сол өтініштің орны аман айынан ғана өтілер, ешқайда да бармайды. Бөтен елде сұлтан болғанша өз елінде ұлтан болған артық. Ағаба, сен не десем өте? Сен...
Қалсын қалайды. Аман айынды саған тасып бетер сайын жоқ. Атан екен, атан екен деп қақылдайсын. Ол қайда? Ол сен де менің де жоқ. Қай жерді жақсы тұрмыз. Сол үшін құтты екен. Осын сөзі дұғарайық. Босқалды болсаңшы жырпаның пайда жоқ.
Жарайды, жарайды мен жұман екенмін.
Kolay olsa. Şu anın bir geçtiğini şimdi kesip gelirim kalayına durat. Kırırmış. Kırırmış.
So, in conclusion, I was drawn to ponder the issue of patriation versus repatriation. When we see ethnic return migration, there are often those who stay, who remain, and define themselves, maybe not even as diaspora, but redefine themselves as members of some other nation. Those who migrate also have to redefine themselves in relationship to a new societal dynamic. But then there's also those who return to Mongolia after a failed attempt to resettle within Kazakhstan. And that's a particularly powerful group that helps redefine the idea of homeland. And particularly raising the question, can we have two? I found that this was an interesting study, not simply because the Mongolian Kazakhs have not been highly studied. Peter Fink did some work on them, but they really haven't been looked at by very many people. But more than that, with 73 million people arguably living in post-Soviet space, living beyond the borders of the territory defined as their ethno-national homeland, I felt that this group was a very interesting case study that could help us understand the process of de- and re-territorialization. More than that, it speaks to issues beyond post-Soviet space, where places like Germany, Israel, even Japan are dealing with returned migrations now, and the question as to whether or not these people have one homeland or two. That's all I have. Thank you. Yes?
Could you say something about the role of ortayus within the societal system?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. The vast majority of Mongolian Kazakhs are, in fact, ortayus. And it became a major issue because they actually have particular taboos on marriage within nine generations along the father's line. And with that small group within Mongolia, it rapidly became a problem in terms of finding people who you could marry. So the idea of branching out beyond the Ortajus became terrifically important as they went back to Kazakhstan. Other than that, the idea of settling in the territory within Kazakhstan that had been the realm of the Ortajus did come up in a number of interviews and surveys.
And why would the Ortajus play this particular role they played within Kazakhstan?
The groups that I was looking at were carrying it back with them. They very much identified themselves abroad in terms of their tribal and Jews identities. When I would introduce myself there, I would often walk in and say, you know, Mening Atanam Alexander, I am Ortajus, I am Naiman, and they would all look at me like, oh, How can you be Ortajus and Naiman? And then it was the way of getting in to let them know that I really understood something about this culture, and I knew that they were, in fact, predominantly that Jews and those particular tribes.
How come they're more strongly represented within academe?
I have no idea. I really don't.
Alex, do you know the percentage of Oromalar who have returned to Mongolia?
The numbers that I had were roughly 20,000 of the 60,000 who migrated during the 90s. The numbers when I revisited in 2005 was about 20,000.
You know, immigration is considered quite successful if no more than 50% of immigrants return to their previous homeland.
Yeah.
So in this regard, the migration of Mongol Kazakhs to Kazakhstan can be considered quite successful.
Yeah. Yes.
You said that Koreans sort of left Mongolia, was it?
No, the Koreans stayed.
Okay. 2010, the Germans and Russians left. Were the only bombs earlier, or was there any forcible repatriation?
Yeah, it'd be difficult. I mean, here comes the question of, is it voluntary migration or forced? With the collapse of the Soviet Union, there were voluntary migrations. During that first book, the surveys basically covered the idea that the Germans saw... I just wrote something about this recently, where it's argued that they had a hard time transcending the status of criminality that derived from the World War II period. And then beyond that, the prospect of returning to a united Germany that's part of the EU was terrifically desirable. But more than that, Germany also had that open door policy, if you could come back and claim it. The Koreans, though, stayed. They redefined themselves as Korean Kazakhstanis and have really endeavored to integrate themselves into the society, to the extent that in the late Soviet period, they saw a lot more intermarriage between Koreans and Russians, and that has changed now, and you're seeing a lot more intermarriage between Koreans and Kazakhs.
Some of them would like to immigrate to South Korea, but they were no means welcome there.
That's the other dimension of that dynamic, is the home state really doing everything they could to discourage that return.
Yeah.
You highlighted the cultural and ethnic shared culture within Mongolia of nomadism and herding culture. Mm-hmm. I was wondering about the Mongolian policy making stance on this in the transitional state. In 2001, Prime Minister Enkbayar, am I pronouncing that right? Mm-hmm. Gave an interview with the... He gave an interview and basically completely dismissed nomadism as a continuation in Mongolia and said that modernization was going to be key. Could you say whether or not that has been enforced, and if modernization has been brought upon Mongolia, what kind of effects that's had in the relationship between the Kazakhs and the Mongols?
That's a good question. I've actually written a couple of things on that recently that should be coming out in some edited volumes. When Enkbayar said that, it was powerful, because there is a strong debate now within Mongolia where they so desperately want to retain the nomadic traditions as a cultural signifier, but they want to modernize the state, and there is a debate as to whether or not those two things are in fact incompatible. What we're seeing now are some very interesting efforts to hybridize it. But in that you're seeing a lot of buildings, concrete buildings built to look like yurts. So it's a sort of tip of the cap to the nomadic heritage. But some of them say, "Oh, it's offensive because this is not mobile." There's a variety of things like that that are actually happening, and the process of modernization is also feared, in that they think it has a certain hegemonic quality that actually once it starts, it will overwhelm Mongolia and strip it of that nomadic past. There's a particular writer named Mendoyu who is talking about how do we find a certain hybrid way of being both modern and nomad. He's talking about introducing solar panels onto to yurts and having satellite dishes and cell phones and all this, but still maintaining a powerful connection to the land. But just one more point: you still find a great many of the Ulaanbaatar-based elites who spend a good percentage of the summer in the countryside. So there is something there. They are still modern, but always going back to try to make sure that they reconnect with the animals and those practices. Yes.
You were in Bayan Olbi.
Mm-hmm.
Amongst the Kazakhs there, did you notice that they were practicing any? Did they like import any form of Mongolian shamanism, or was there like Kazakh shamanism on its own? Were there shamans? Or was shamanism gone?
I didn't do much on that, honestly, but I haven't seen much of it out there. What I did see was a revitalization of Islam. often they were sending students off to be trained in Turkey and places like that. Most of them didn't come back, but those who did, they were rebuilding mosques, and people were trying to learn about Islam again.
So then the Kazakh identity is more closely tied with obviously Islam than like any form of Turkic shamanism at all.
To my knowledge, yes.
Thank you.
So my name is Marjan Arena. I'm a teacher of Kazakh.
Mm.
Yes. And I'm a teacher of Kazakh at the Central Asian Kalmanskaya. So I'm interested in the contribution of Mongolian during the development of virgin lands. Does this aspect take place in your research work, and what was that contribution, if yes? So that was 1953-54, years, when many people from many countries came to Kazakhstan for the first time during virgin lands. So do you research the contribution of Mongolian people in your work?
I have not looked at that.
Actually, no foreigners came to develop the virgin lands. All migrants were from the Soviet Union.
From the Soviet Union, there were.
Not from any other country.
From Mongolia, there were no, yes?
No.
Oh, that was interesting for me. Thank you.
Sure. Yes.
Are both the Kazakhs and the Mongols attempting to Romanize their languages, their alphabets, and to what extent has that been successful?
No, Kazakhstan has decided to stick with the Cyrillic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Whereas...
No.
They
request a new law about gradual transition to the literature.
How are they going to do that now?
It was said by Mr. Baev a couple years ago.
Okay. Well, there you have that. Mongolia, there was some talk early on of trying to go with the Toad script, the old kind of Uyghur Toad script.
Right.
They looked at it, then they threw it out, and they, to my knowledge, are sticking with the Cyrillic.
I'm curious. Several kind of different definitions of space, or several actors defining space in a different way and how it interacts in your argument. I don't know if this is an anachronistic question, but are there ever elements of, you know, say like pan-Turkism or pan-Slavism interacting with these concepts of the Kazakhstan is our homeland, or well, but Bayan-Olghi is kind of our homeland too, because we've been able to maintain our Kazakh identity there. Does that interact with these sort of broader concepts of space that transcend national boundaries? Or?
Yeah, I didn't hear much talk of pan-Turkism there. It hasn't really come up. The idea of a Kazakh identity has become increasingly important to them, particularly with the emergence of an independent Kazakhstan. That really set this off. It's when there was a country with borders and governments, and it was the land of the Kazakhs. It revitalized a sense of Kazakhness abroad. That took it from an ethnic identity to more of a national identity again, where they, and many of these groups migrated prior to the nationalization of Kazakhs.
Mm-hmm.
And now abroad, that nationalization occurred, and it was very much connecting to that new country.
Response to this in Almaty in Kazakhstan. I have seen bumper stickers that say Turkistan. Exactly. So that's not entirely
I was wondering if you've done any, taken any comparative looks at other examples of repatriation of ethnic groups from one country back to their homeland. I was thinking maybe in the case of the Turks that were in Bulgaria that were sent back to Turkey itself, and also to some extent the Albanians in Kosovo that were sent, during the Kosovo War, they were sent into the Republic of Albania itself. Have you looked at the fate of those peoples compared to this area?
Well, you know, I've read that stuff,
mm-hmm.
but really a future project is really to try to engage in a more comparative study.
Mm-hmm.
So that is one of the next steps.
Good.
Since the deterritorialization, reterritorialization has not been institutionalized, it has not been forced per se, like really pushed in the media and through national sentiments and so on. But Kazakhs have, as I understand, a pretty comfortable position in Mongolia. They have, you know, this area where they're concentrated. They're not, you know, the highest ethnic group. They're maybe second among equals, as you say in their 2005 article, but they don't really have much of an objection to that. What's the incentive for them, other than ethnic loyalty, to return to go to Kazakhstan, where you might think that they would understand that they're the foreigners, they're weird? Why would they leave?
You know, it's interesting. Louisa Waugh wrote Hearing Birds Fly, and she described portions of Bayan-Olghi as being almost an ethnic apartheid between Kazakhs and Mongols. I didn't see that. I really didn't see that kind of antagonism. But the fact that she actually writes about it speaks to perhaps some greater tension than I identified. Beyond that, surveys showed that when Kazakhs wanted to leave, it was often relating to the prospect of their children having a life as part of the titular group, that they felt that they would be privileged then in Kazakhstan. More than that, there was a sense that Bayan-Olghi is marginalized, that with the collapse of those supply lines, they really didn't have industry, they didn't have a lot going economically. So Kazakhstan was defined in their minds as a very sophisticated, modern country. And just looking at the world, a lot of people thought, my children will be better off raised there.
Alex, another reason. Since the second half of the 1990s, the living standards in Kazakhstan became much higher than the living standards in Mongolia.
Yeah. And I've actually heard some of the Bayan-Olghi Kazakhs talking about the oil. And the prospects of Kazakhstan becoming a rich oil state and then being able to jump on that.
You mentioned that the Kazakhs who returned from Mongolia, Western Mongolia, had used the word pure, a more pure form of Kazakh. So you said that they didn't have as many loan words, but was that really a hindrance for them to reintegrate? I'm assuming it would have been, because their Kazakh would probably have been anachronized at that point, because they probably spoken before they left. Did you have a chance to speak with those who returned, and were you able to hear their version of Kazakh?
Yeah, and you know, there were some of the cultural debates got pretty heated. There were Mongolian Kazakhs who came back and were called, some really resented the idea of being called Oroman. They didn't like it. They felt that label othered them within Kazakhstan. They said, why aren't we just Kazakhs? Why are we Oroman? Secondly, there were those who came back and were called Mongolian. They said, well, you're not really Kazakh, you're Mongolian, or you're Chinese. And they said, no, I'm Kazakh. And then thirdly, there were those who came back, and this wasn't large scale, but there were those who came back and they really resented some of the Russification. To come back and speak Kazakh and have an ethnic Kazakh respond to you in Russian offended some of these Kazakhs because of the ideals that they held coming back. And I would hear people whisper at times, these aren't Kazakhs anymore, these are Black Russians.
And Alex, wasn't it also the case, if I'm remembering this right, that sort of that idea of a pure, untainted, unrussified culture, a real Kazakh population that hadn't undergone those processes, were also used in a political sense by those pushing Kazakhization within Kazakhstan.
Right.
And so they became sort of a tool to push that agenda.
Right, a pawn.
If I'm remembering.
Yeah, it was. And then they found themselves often troubled because there's a village-city dichotomy within Kazakhstan. If somebody stumbles on something, they say, oh, sorry, I'm from the village. The Kazakhs often got caught in that rural-urban split in society as well. So the Oroman they found themselves in a rather difficult position. At times, resented by locals who felt like they were getting special treatment. At times, resented when they were settled in the homes abandoned by Germans or Russians, because sometimes the neighbors were German and Russian, and these guys came in not even speaking Russian. So that made that changed the neighborhood dynamic as well.
I know that for many years it was the practice on maps that were published in Taiwan. They would show the borders of China, including substantial parts of Mongolia. Do you know what the justification of that was for doing that?
During the Manchurian period, Outer Mongolia was a protectorate, essentially part of the broader Chinese spectrum. It was after 1915 when the Mongolia gained its independence and then eventually evolved into the Mongolian People's Republic that those borders stayed solid. But it would consistently serve in that buffer role between Russia and China. Yes.
I was curious about the. You know, we showed the map of sort of the areas that in Kazakhstan that where these people who were mainly pastoralists could move and sort of survive. To what extent today has that sort of that migration changed those landscapes into being more Kazakh than they were before, in the sense of, you know, being before having the return migration, you know, a lot of those areas, like you mentioned, were either part of predominantly Uzbek or Russian. What is the kind of makeup there?
Yeah, I had this grand plan, I had this big table, I did all this great. It was my effort toward quantitative research. I was going to do this whole thing on this is what does the population during this time, and then after the return migration, I could show that the oblasts that were more ethnically Russian got more immigrants. I thought this was going to work great. The problem was with the secondary my migrations, it became really difficult to track. So it's very difficult to answer the question. You can go there and you can see that there is a greater Kazakh presence in some of these northern oblasts now. But there really has been a policy by the Nazarbayev regime to try to push people north. Just look at the resettlement of the capital from Almaty to Astana. I mean, that wasn't by accident that they moved it up to that town. You have something?
Sure. Could you talk a little bit more about the decision process to return migrants? So you talked some about the different types of considerations that might motivate someone to do so, but I'm more concerned about the social aspects of that process. Were there organizations that sought to promote this idea of return migration? Were there movement entrepreneurs who saw this as a way to promote their visibility within the community? Did they receive resources and support from the Kazakh government? Was it an explicit policy trying to recruit returned migrants? I mean, how did that whole process unfold socially, as opposed to just individual households making a decision?
That's a good question, and it has multiple levels. There was a group called Atayan that did try to agitate for return migration from within Bainolgi, but their agenda got really loose, and at one point they wanted to reclaim Xinjiang, turn it into some kind of a new... It didn't work well. What else happened there? There were a lot of elites within Ulaanbaatar, Kazakh elites who had access to the internet, who had access to Kazakh language newspapers. These guys started writing newspaper articles, and when they went to the countryside in the summer, started talking about this. Now, some of them deny it now. Some of them say, I wasn't the one who pushed it, because with dissatisfaction with return migration, they don't want to be the ones to carry that. But also, when I asked families, how did this happen? They often said, well, an Aksakal, a graybeard, decides. And then pretty much the family goes. And they would often send a scout. A young male would often go, travel a bit, decide, I think we might be best if we settled here. They would then petition the Kazakhstani government to let them go there. But also, there was a strong discourse emanating out of Kazakhstan, wherein Nazarbayev and others talked about, you know, brothers should come home. The 4 million Kazakhs abroad who should migrate back to Kazakhstan. So there was a government-sponsored process there, too.
My understanding of Central Asian society is still kind of basic. In amongst Kazakhs, I understand that before they became, you know, Kazakhified, they were divided into tribes. Is the tribal identity still of any consequence within Kazakhstan? Like, do Kazakhs say, like, oh yes, I'm a Kazakh, of the you know, X tribe?
Ed Schatz, who also got his PhD here in Wisconsin, Ed Schatz has actually written about this. Very good stuff. He has a book from the University of Washington Press. You can look at that, where you know, he says that, and there have been debates as to how much it plays into Nazarbayev's regime. Did he draw largely from the Ulazhuz? Some say yes, some say no. Some say that actually it plays in to certain things, that isn't really my field.
Alex, could you follow up with that and just speak to the question of the Mongolian Kazakhs that you were studying and their decision to return, in the sense of if that level of identity played a role? Because as you said, many of them left before Kazakhization or before Kazakh national identity is really firmly established. So are they going back just to go back to Kazakhstan? Are they going back to go back to the region they see as home, which is much more local?
Yeah, and I definitely saw that specific questions when I'd say, if you're migrating, do you just want to go back to Kazakhstan? And many said, well, yes, but of course I would have to live in the land of the Naiman. Of course, I would have to live in the land of the Kerey. Of course, I would want to be settled in the land of my ancestors, the Ordos.
That's not Kazakhs.
Right, so it definitely played in there. Yeah. And sometimes, actually, these guys found themselves a little bit resentful when other Kazakhs weren't as forthcoming with their tribal identities. Yeah.
Those 20,000 that you said returned to Mongolia,
they had a very difficult time of it, because often they spent everything that they had to go, and then some suffered tragedies there, loss of children, whatever, and then they would end up migrating back, and it cost them most of what they had. But the Mongolian Kazakh community was fairly well integrated, so that once back, they could depend on those clan family connections to get them back, have animals again, reestablish herds, reestablish property. But it was a tough transition.
And another follow up on that: do those coming back then, because of that experience, become more, you know, firmly sort of feeling about having a stronger feeling that Mongolia is our true homeland, and so they're the ones even pushing that kind of
Most certainly. They would come back and talk, and interestingly, this is where it's not just a clear black and white idea of this is home and that isn't. They were still very happy that a Kazakhstan exists. They like that there's an independent Kazakhstan there. But this group started to return to those who never left and said, but you're right, we can be Kazakh here too. And in fact, that's when talk about Bayan-Olghi as our homeland, this is where we opened our eyes, this is where we drink its water, and all those type of metaphors come in to speak to this bond that they have. And Mongolia's been pretty open to it. They've reached out and said, you are fellow felt tent dwellers, you belong.
I was just curious if you had any numbers on Xinjiang Kazakhs and how many went in
return? I started down that road, and when I began to think about the research process there, the human subjects protocols just seemed too daunting, and because the questions that I was asking could have gotten people in trouble, so I just didn't even research them much.
These Germans that were repatriated to Germany during this period, did they still speak German? Because I know that a lot of ethnic Germans that were brought back or repatriated to Germany during this period actually had no knowledge of the language at all, yet they were eligible for citizenship instantly.
Yeah, that was one of the big issues. And then most of them, no. But when they got back there, that's when Germany started imposing a language test. To make sure that the people could. To follow up on yours, there is a table in the book that says there's this many Afghanistani Kazakhs who came back, Xinjiang Kazakhs, Iran, Turkey. So I do have some data on that in there, if that's of use. Yeah.
The Kazakhs that have remained in Mongolia, would you say that it's really noticeable, the significant numbers of, like, have they been reduced very much as a minority? And if they're suffering because of that, like, the Mongolians coming back in the elite, are they trying to, enforce Mongolianism, especially in places like the Bayan Olgi, trying to take it back as a Mongolian place, or are they still keeping their imprint there very much as Kazakh?
They are. The autonomous aspect of Bayan Olgi has been debated a little. There was an article called, "Do We Need Another Yurt Inside Our Yurt?" But I think the Mongols have also said, you know, they've handled it out there. They've actually done well out there. And if it's just there, they can have a measure of autonomy. But they noticed the loss. They noticed the loss because what they lost were a lot of the cultural elites, and that left the group behind. It was a fairly integrated social network, feeling like there were serious gaps. And there's actually a song, I think I quoted in the book somewhere, the lyrics, one of the very, very popular song was really about this, singing to those who left and talking about the missing, the longing, the gaps within society. But they lost their opera singers. They lost their, because those people could go back to Kazakhstan and have the lives that they dreamed of. They lost a lot of doctors. They lost a lot of, you know, elites.
If I understood the two clips you showed, was the implication of those two clips that that concept of homeland is very confused and there's no concrete understanding amongst Kazakhs of what the homeland really is?
Well, yeah, it was supposed to show that there were different voices with very different, clearly different ideas as to what constituted homeland. The Alima, the daughter-in-law, she was a Xinjiang-born Kazakh who felt no compulsion to go back to Kazakhstan. The grandmother did. Zamanai talked about being a bait animal because he was taken out of the land of his ancestors. And that interesting, the Red Army officer clearly saying, you know, who are you to come back here and tell us what our culture is? You ran away. We stayed. So those voices exist, and I basically use those just to show you that this is a conversation that is ongoing.
I was just curious. You mentioned that some of the Kazakhs in Bayan Olgi are sending their children to schools abroad for Islamic education. Is there any kind of like separate migration pattern of Kazakhs moving between countries based on their Islamic identity rather than their Kazakh identity? Or, because when you mentioned that, you said that some of them don't actually return.
Yeah, I don't have much data on that. I do know that there were a couple of mosques being built, and when I would go and ask the local mullah, like where were you trained? And he talked about being sent abroad and then coming back, and how he was part of a larger group. He said most did not return, but I really don't have much data.
Do you have any idea how that mosque building was financed?
Some of it is clearly done with just local money, but there is some, you know, when I would ask about that, people got quiet too.
Well, many mosques
in Saudi Arabia,
decades in
Istanbul. Yeah.
Yeah. And the sources, I think, pretty obvious.
Yeah.
And the Kazakhstan government stopped this practice a few years ago.
They stopped taking the Saudi money?
Is there one more question? Well, there's certainly been a lot of them, so it's a testimony to the interest and to the dynamic performance of our speaker today. So let's thank him.
Thank you.